Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting because I'm finally back in Jerusalem. So broadcasting from Jerusalem, shalom and welcome. And shalom and welcome to the Pardes Institute, and that means shalom and welcome to Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, shalom and welcome.
Oh, shalom, Yishai. It's good to see you back.
It's great to be back. It's the Shabbat of Parshat Tetzaveh, and that means it's also the Shabbat before Purim this year.
Shabbat Zachor.
That means there's a big mitzvah to hear the Torah portion of the about Amalek. Like, don't forget.
Don't forget to wipe it out.
Don't forget to forget.
Don't forget to wipe your memory.
Right, exactly. Don't forget to log out. And so,
note to self, don't remember.
That's right. It's like, what was that show, movie called? Memento?
They show the whole thing backwards?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Remember to forget.
Yes.
Remember to forget. Is that a good name for the show? Remember to forget?
I think so.
I like that. Remember to forget.
Anyway.
So it's a big weekend coming up, and we got a big next week. We got to get ready to party hard next week.
I'm ready.
Yeah, you got to be ready.
Well, I'm an otter baby. I just had my birthday. I'm feeling like the power of the mazel, as it were, flowing through me more and more every day. I'm a little nervous, actually, what's going to happen in class this afternoon.
Okay.
Just I'm on that much on edge.
Okay. I want to first wish you a big happy birthday.
Oh, thank you so much.
And I heard you went on a tour with your family.
Unbelievable. Eretz Yisrael right now is showing its colors like you cannot even imagine.
I have to make a plan to take the kids.
Jaw-dropping. I've been here now for 19 years.
Yeah.
And I've never seen the Jordan Valley. And it's only like just begun, right? It's only just begun.
Yes.
It looked like Scotland. It looked like, I don't know, it was that rich. I don't know.
So the land is very, very flowering right now, very flourishing. Today's one of these clear blue days. We haven't had so many of these, what Mark and I call yellow ball. We just call it yellow ball. Yellow ball is when you look in the Google weather and it just has a picture of a yellow ball. So it's like, it's a yellow ball day out there, just still cooler than summertime a tad. And everything seems like really, really wondrous and wonderful.
It's that spring has sprung feeling.
Spring has sprung after a satisfying winter.
You feel good about it. That's it.
That's it.
You can feel good about the sunshine today.
Right, right. Because it was a real, real winter, and everything is just like swimmingly. You know that expression in America, "lucky in love, unlucky in cards," something like that.
Something like that.
Which just means to say, like, look, you got to take your blessings, but there's going to be other things.
You can't have it all.
You can't have it all. And so the land is flourishing, and the people seem jovial and alive, and the nation's growing and procreating and being fruitful and multiplying, and there's economics. Politically speaking, country is yet again on edge after yet again a third election.
There's an important intersection there.
Right.
I mean, part of it, I remember we voted and then left on this teal, and I actually said to Karen, to my wife, as we're heading out, I said, I wonder what percentage of people like cast their vote and then just head out for Bilui, for like recreation right now.
Yeah.
And whether you could do a cross-section of who voted for who and what did you do right after you voted. Because remember, like, even though it was a vacation day, I mean, the essential services were all functioning. The buses were running.
Yeah.
I mean, there's plenty of people that had to go to work.
Sure. But a lot of the nation went out.
I'm telling you, huge.
And you know how they measure it. You know how they measure it. They measure it with on the news of the day of the elections. They talk about how much money was exchanged.
Yes.
And it was, I don't know.
It was astronomical.
It was something like 600 million shekel.
Which, a good chunk of which was mine, by the way. I don't want you to know that now. But my point was, is I had this sense of bracha, of blessing. Right. Like, we were on top of the Hermon, and there are literally like 100 Indonesian tourists singing hymns in their native language. Indonesian, presumably. I don't really know. I'm kidding. My kids were asking me, like, what's going on? And the place is booming. Am Yisrael is like enjoying on that level. You feel this sense of Kodesh Baruch Hu saying, I just want to give you.
Right.
I just want to give you.
Right.
And yet, right now, we lack the kelim to really receive the big bracha.
You know what? Let me just throw out, I think you think it was you on the show, or maybe somebody else, who told me some months ago that when the government's at deadlock, the libertarians are like, this is great. This proves that, you see, we need less of a big government, less of an activist government, and more power to the people and less power to the government. And so maybe that in part is what happened.
Listen, at the same time, there are some big opportunities. What I meant was that I'm definitely not interested in government for government's sake. I'm much more on the libertarian side in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But we as a people have much more to do than manage our daily affairs or our economic affairs or our political affairs. We have a mission.
Right.
And
but maybe that mission keeps going.
It, for sure. No, I'm not saying the mission doesn't stop. But my point is that the ideal is that the malchut, the government, is meant to be a vessel for being able to do that mission writ large.
If it's a malchut.
It is.
If it's in malchut mode.
It's always a malchut. It can be a malchut b'kukula or b'tikuna. No, it's always a malchut.
If the malchut is weak, then it's
b'kukula, and it's not doing the mission, and it can actually come out poorly. You've read the Bible.
Yeah, but I'm saying there are times where the government is weak, but the people are doing their thing. They keep going. And here in Israel, since the government and the state has a kind of secular tone to it, then the people underneath are growing and learning and connecting with the land and doing their stuff. Anyway, I got to tell you, I had a humongous, unbelievable, crazy week. Since my last show, I had a big event Thursday night at CPAC that I ran, and it had two important congressmen, Congressman Biggs, Congressman Mark Meadows. They both spoke about the rights of Jews in Judea and Samaria. Friday morning, I spoke on the big stage at CPAC in front of like 10,000 people and maybe 20 million watching. So I was on the big stage there. Then we had a Shabbaton at CPAC for the Young Jewish Conservatives. And then from there on Saturday night, I went to an OU cigar party, okay, and met important folks and all that. And then Sunday morning went to APAC, saw all the Jews there and all the action there, heard all the two-state crap that they try to feed you over there, and yet was awed as usual by the great conglomeration of pro-Israel Jews that gather down in Washington. Then I flew home, knackered, as we say,
in the British Isles,
and yet came home, voted, went to yoga, because I wanted to stretch out my back, which actually ended up tightening my back up. But then next morning went to a meeting at the Yesha Council about a summertime event, and then went to I-24 TV to help analyze the election results.
Just sounds brutal.
And came home last night, and here I am with you today. And also last night, like, fell asleep at like 8. Woke up at about 11.
Oh no!
And read the Megillah for 2 hours in preparation of the show with you today. So it's been quite harrowing, and I still have video to edit, monies to pay, contacts to log. What do you call it? File
input.
Whatever it is, input. Yeah, some data input. So lots of stuff. Still a lot of monies that I have to deal with in and out and all that kind of stuff. And anyway, bottom line is it's been very, very alive.
And it ain't over yet.
It ain't over yet, Bichlal. And we got to come into Purim. And the government seemed at first that it was a great victory for Prime Minister Netanyahu. It still was a great victory for Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Considering everything he's got stacked against him, it's a pretty impressive showing.
We're talking about 59, let's say, on the average. It might be 58. It might be 60.
Right.
We'll see. But let's say 59 seats out of 120 are not just... 59 seats were for Netanyahu and partners that were bemutar with announced coalition, pre-coalition for Netanyahu.
No, because 59 includes Lieberman.
No, it does not.
Yes, it does.
No, it certainly does not. If it included Lieberman, it would be 60. We'd be the done deal a long time
ago.
No, 59 is...
Lieberman?
Not including Lieberman, 100%.
I've been misreading these numbers.
No. 59 is...
Likud, Shas,
Yadut HaTorah, and...
Yamina.
And Yamina, that's it. That's the people who came into this election saying, we will be with Netanyahu. That's half the nation, without ifs, ands, or buts, stood behind Netanyahu. The rest of the parties, they're not one. It's not like it's one. Everybody stood behind...
No. Well, I'll tell you what they stood behind.
Not Netanyahu. They stood behind that. But first thing, you had a huge turnout for the Arab vote, which is in itself an issue to deal with and to contemplate.
This is an important moment, in my opinion, in Israeli politics.
Certainly.
In many ways, I feel like what's on the table right now is, do we envision the Zionism as the movement for the self-determination of Am Yisrael or not anymore?
Right.
I feel like that's what's on. That's why, by the way, if people don't understand why Benny Gantz isn't willing to just do the easy move and take the Arabs into his party, et cetera, although it might not be so easy at this point. But he's been, well, it's not just because he's some racist or an Arab hater, and it's also not just because it'd be bad politics, which it would. It's because he actually is still wedded to this classic Zionist secular notion that the whole purpose here is a self-determination for the Jewish people.
Right.
And to make that even dependent upon a minority partner in your government undermines the vision without any prejudice toward the Arabs as people or citizens.
Let's kind of unpack that just a tad. If the Arab parties would be like, listen, we stand behind you all the way. We're just a minority in the land, but we support fully. And there were minorities like that. For example, Ayub Kara of the Druze, who used to be a minister in the Likud.
Sure.
He was like, I am with you, Am Yisrael. I am a Druze. I got my religion, my thing. I'm a minority here. But I want you guys to succeed, and I want you to sweep of us, our minority, up as well in the success of it. That is not what the Arab parties stand for at all. They're not saying that at all.
Well, it's a competing national narrative at this point.
Right. And these guys have never, ever, not once in Israeli history, have joined an Israeli government. Recently,
Invited?
They've never joined an Israeli government because of their stance. Ayman Uda recently stated on Twitter, you know, where all things happen, he said, we're not Israeli Arabs. He said, we're not the Arabs of anybody, he said. And I understood what he said. He said, listen, I'm not an Israeli Arab. I'm an Arab. I'm an Arab nationalist. I'm more in line with Palestine, although I don't want to live in Palestine because that's not good for my body, right?
Who would want to live there?
Right. But I stand for the idea of Palestine. I'll take your paycheck. I'll take your buses and your health care and all that, and I'll never want to move to Palestine. But I am a Palestinian because I want to eat, you know, both cakes, have my cake and eat it too. And I am fully not – I am saying I do not identify with you Jews, Israeli Zionists, etc. Okay, and same thing with on the Palestinian side, saying that this election was all about annexation and racism and blah blah blah.
Yeah, but leave the Arabs aside for a minute, because it's really, I think, not. Let's put it this way: it's not what's of interest to me here. What's of interest to me is the project that we're engaged in from a political standpoint, is the goal the self-determination of Am Yisrael, or not? Is the goal the opposite, which is a secular nation state.
So what you mean is
citizens.
When you have the word Jewish and democratic,
which one tips the scale?
Right. And what I'm always saying to people is the term Jewish and democratic is a conflicted thing.
What's oxymoron.
An oxymoron within itself. I don't know
if it's intrinsically an oxymoron.
It cannot be co-equal. There is no way that two different systems can be co-equal. Jewish means an ethnicity. Okay, it means favoring a certain group. Democratic means not favoring a certain group.
Well, but this is exactly my point, is that if you look into secular Zionism...
Unless you mean Jewish and democratic. Unless what you mean is Japanese and democratic, meaning to say we will have a democracy for Jews.
Right, but that's what it originally meant, because that was the secular Zionist dream. It was what I think of as Brighton Beach Judaism, which is we're all going to be Jews because we're all Jews. We're all going to live, the bus driver's Jewish... The guy who owns the McCullough is Jewish. They say, why? Because we're Jews. It doesn't necessarily have any substantive, certainly not necessarily any mission-oriented. It's just a reality. And that's why, by the way, particularly for secular Zionists, but for most Zionists, the Arabs have always represented the fly in the ointment. It's like, because we're like, whoa, like really? Like all we wanted was to just like be a bunch of Jews together and be able to not have that conversation you just pointed out.
Right.
And the Arabs, to their credit, have sort of always said, but we're us. We're not going to be what you want us to be. And we've never been able to deal forthrightly with it.
Right. I don't know if it's to their credit or not. To me, the choice today is clear. Either go towards disenfranchisement, mm-hmm. which is some kind of move which says, listen, this is actually a democracy for Jews and minorities that are willing to play ball. Mm-hmm. If you're outside of that, based on some kind of loyalty thing, you're out. So like an effort towards recognition that we have to disenfranchise the jihadist and the other element. That's one path. And the other path is, it's a similar path, but it says it's a little bit more, let's say, positive, which is let's identify the pro-Israel Arabs or force more people to be pro-Israel Arabs, okay?
You can't force to be, but you could convince.
Oh, you could force. Oh, you could plenty force. In many countries, you force things.
Force things to be pro? No, you can suppress.
You could say, listen, if you, meaning to say what I mean by, you're right, what I mean is cajole, meaning to say, but I mean cajole like
you force people to make a decision.
Yeah, if you want X, Y, and Z, which we have, you have to do X, Y, and Z.
By the way, you want to know where the path forward is, and practically speaking, what you're talking about?
No.
Is it, and it speaks also to the heart of the other side of the coin, because remember, the right relies upon a somewhat non-Zionist element in its government as well. You know, you think that Yadut HaTorah sees the secular state of Israel as the embodiment of the self-determination of Am Yisrael? No.
I think that they're
in Shas,
it's a
question.
I think they're in a transition zone right now.
I'm not as certain as you are.
I listen to Haredi radio a lot, and I listen to how they talk, and I see that they are themselves in a process of trying to understand the relationship. They are not quite clear about it.
Similar, by the way, to the Arabs, because in both cases, I actually happen to believe that neither of their leadership is serving their people so well in that respect. But my point was to say that the way forward in, I would say, clarifying who's enfranchised. You want to stay away from disenfranchisement. Strike the ear as well.
Yeah, I'm. I know that, and I said it on purpose.
I know
I'm
you
like,
did.
I'm like. It's okay. Let's just start.
Whatever. We can have that discussion another time. My point is that on some level, full citizenship should be related to national service. Meaning full citizenship. By which
right.
I mean voting.
Voting. Right.
You want to vote.
By the way, that's another interesting thing. And I mean this as a question mark. Since when is citizenship
equal voting?
Necessarily with voting. Also, since when is liberalism the same as enfranchisement of voting? Meaning to say, I say to people, Israel is liberal in the sense that it wants to grant liberties.
Yes.
But I want to give you a Bill of Rights.
It's socially liberal.
Right. I want to give you liberties, you know, the classic liberties of freedoms, of speeches, freedom of speech, and et cetera.
Yeah.
But not necessarily voting. I always reference the Puerto Rico system,
which we've spoken about, is I think of somewhat use here as a model, but I think we could stretch ourselves better. But I want to finish my point. There is I think that the way forward, and the reason I brought up the Haredi world is because there's a challenge there as well. Much of the Haredi world not only does not participate in national service, not in the army, and not in just the general national service options, but it uses as a political device the sort of energy around refusing that as a symbol of, like, we haven't sold out to the state.
Right.
Which there are deep parallels with what happens in the Arab world. And by the way, I think both of them lose out just on a practical level. Mm-hmm. Chaval, you could do so much within your own community, plus the army.
Right.
But I think that there's a model saying, if you serve, you vote. Everybody gets those civil liberties you're speaking about.
Right.
Now, it's true that there's going to be a problem with the economics and distribution of resources, but I got news for you. There's a very easy solution for that. Then serve. It's much better than this loyalty oath idea, which I think is, like, who cares? On some level, there's plenty of people in the world who will swear whatever they want them to swear to.
Mm-hmm.
But to serve. And to then, by the way, the army is the most effective tool still within our country, with all of its warts and bumps. And it's also, by the way, the biggest source of consensus within Israeli society as an institution that people trust. So meaning the if you serve, you vote. I'm not going to fall into the trap of citizenship and all the mm-hmm. mumbo jumbo around that and the hot button issues of second class citizen. No, mm-hmm. Let's just talk practically. Because that makes sense to me. Wait a minute. We're a country that's been at war for 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, and if you don't want to go to war, I understand why an Arab living in Umm al-Fahm might not want to go to war, since it's likely he's going to feel a sense of kinship with the people we're fighting. I get that. Okay, but you still have to serve. There are other ways to serve.
Right. Well, I think service as a natural linkage with voting makes sense.
As prerequisite, I'm saying.
A prerequisite. I think that makes a lot of sense. Of course, you're going to have a lot of the Haredim and the Arabs are going to protest that.
Sure.
But there is one additional factor which can be added into it, which can make it easier, and that is that the consciousness of national service, the machinery of national service in the country, which is, just to explain what that means all kinds of
non-governmental organizations,
right.
Social organizations,
right.
Volunteer organizations.
Right. And doing that, and so as opposed to the army, could also count towards national service.
That's what I mean.
Right. And what I used to say is, okay, so let's have everybody serve for 2 years.
Yeah.
And everybody comes out with a card that says, I served.
Which is your voting card.
Which is your voting card. Which is your voting.
And if you don't want to do it, bavakasha, we will have institutionalized in law your civil rights. You will be able to function economically freely. You'll have a passport that you can travel on. You know what you can't do? You can't make the decisions that set the goral, mm-hmm. that set the fate. Why? Mm-hmm. Because you decided that you didn't want to do that mm-hmm. for whatever reason. And, of course, it would have to be adjudicated, and there are going to be exceptions, and there's going to be the – and by the way, I think that the violent politics that would come out of it would be healthy because in the end of the day, yeah, that – I think we could rally a lot of our country.
So you're saying we can homogenize the state around this principle of service.
Homogenize is an interesting word, I think that's like part of it.
You
there's a leveling of the
right. There's a certain homogenization, which is like, look, this is a state, and you're Haredi, and I get it, and you've got a different thing, and I'm not asking you to wave the flag, and I'm not asking you to hug Ben Gurion, and I'm not asking you to sing the anthem even.
Yeah.
But there is it is a state mechanism, and it has a certain bit. And if you want to vote in that state mechanism,
yeah, you want full citizenship, you got to have full buy-in.
Full buy-in, okay.
Right.
And same thing with the Arabs. You can't just sit there and snipe and snipe and snipe and snipe, and that's what they've really been doing.
Yeah, sure.
From the beginning of the state, and now with
before.
Right, but I'm saying within the parliamentary system, I'm talking about sniping within Israeli democracy.
I think that's changing, man. I'd be very curious to know whether how much Ayman Uda's claim that there were a lot of Jewish votes that helped push his numbers up. I'd like to know how true that is.
Yeah, I'd like to know that how true that is also. And I'd like to also experiment and see if there was an Arab Knesset member / minister in the Likud who was a pro-Israel Arab. How many could he pull in?
This is the next stage. It's because suddenly, if you open up this very clear differentiation, there becomes an incentive for an Arab leadership that says, yeah, I'm Israeli.
Right. And that's what Ayman Uda was saying. I'm saying I'm not Israeli.
And you could gather a lot of political power there.
By the way,
a subset of the Arab society which has shown itself willing to buy into the society, not because they see themselves as Uncle Tom's or said, no, because they're wake up, smell the coffee, this is a successful venture. And I'm going to get out of it what I put into it.
Right.
And frankly, in our educational system, in our political system, need to start saying very clearly, and I got news for you. You know why this is the one successful venture in the Middle East? Because we're Am Yisrael. And you want to be on board for that great journey that's going to overturn the world? Great. You don't? We're not going to oppress you because we've learned from that. But we're also not going to enfranchise you to undermine our project.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing we're not willing to talk about right now. Mm-hmm. It's like the whole either you're a victim or a perpetrator. That whole false dichotomy. It's like we feel like we have to fully enfranchise these people, even though they'll tell us to our faces that they're going to use that power. Not all of them, but enough of them. Their
leadership.
Yeah, their leadership. You know, we're going to use that power to undermine you. And we feel like, well, but if we're not the victims here, then we're going to be the perpetrators, and that we're not willing to do.
Right.
There's another way. There's another
right.
way.
Right.
You know, and I feel like that's a very specific.
It would be nice if there was Arab voices that would come out and also say things like that.
True, but I think until we give them that safe space,
right.
You know well, amongst the people that you speak to under the PA, until they have the safe space and the incentive to do that.
I mean, if there was any person born ever in the Arab world who had the incentive and had the life. And had everything to gain by standing up for Israel, it was Ayman Uda.
Ah, but see, there's the other piece that we're not talking about, was he was politicized from a very young age. And the history, I just did an episode on the role that the Communist Party has played in the creation of Palestinian nationalism within our country, mm-hmm. which has been, from the beginning,
right.
the core. And he's Hadash, if people are probably unaware, his party, Hadash, is not technically an Arab party.
Right, it's the Communist Party.
It is the latest iteration of the Israeli Communist Party, which is technically Arab-Jewish. I mean, there is always a reserved space, which used to be, by the way, there was a reserved space for an Arab member. That was Maki in the old days, though it was, right? It has demographically shifted in that worldview sort of morphed into the Arab world, and it was the inception of our homegrown version of Palestinian nationalism comes straight from the Communist Party. So the politicization that he received from a very young age has allowed him to frame all those reasons of privilege and safety and his very right to speak the way he does to a country in which anywhere else you throw a stone from our border and you talk like that. It ain't gonna end well. We'll just leave it like that.
The only thing is, I know where he grew up. and I know the life that he led.
Right. We've spoken, yeah.
And
but that's but that proves what I'm saying. Because there's no other reason other than the politicization. Meaning, you, once you grab someone's consciousness and you force it into a frame, everything looks right to them.
Yeah. Yeah, but it didn't have to go that way in his
head.
No,
it didn't. That's on us, buddy. We've failed. Come on, we have failed in our ability. Rabbi Mike,
I hear you.
What can we do?
But give me a break a little bit. Like, okay, I hear you. But on the other hand, it really, he's a piece of trash. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
I don't know the guy personally.
No, I do know him personally. You know, I played in that playground with him, and I know exactly where he's from. I know exactly where he lived. And he lived in every single Israeli privilege that could have been given to him. Every single one. The best, happiest, luckiest Arab. And he comes from a minority of Muslims, a type of Muslim which is persecuted.
So
and
now
only
I'll
Israel
speak to you as a counselor.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense to me then that what he needs to do now is to prove that he owes the Jews nothing.
Okay.
Because to reclaim his identity, his manhood, you want to go there, we get all those
his
things.
Palestinian identity.
To reclaim that, but that sense of empowerment, like I'm not beholden to.
Right.
Because there's a huge narrative out there that's calling him an Uncle Tom. I mean, that's a big part of the backstory of the Israeli Arabs, is that they're the ones who didn't run away, right? But they're also the ones that are the traitors. They're living on the inside. You know, there's a messy, messy dynamic. I've been doing a lot of research to what's been translated into English in the dialogue between the Palestinian, the Arabs who stayed in Israel after 48 and the ones who did not. Mm-hmm. And it gets really ugly in there in both ways. And so I could say that in many ways it makes sense to me that the only way to use all of that advantage is to dismantle the structure that created the privilege to begin with,
which is
a big 21st century thing.
Which is basically a fancy way of saying ingrate.
It's worse than that. It's also fool.
Right. And
because like you said, that Palestine that you want to create, you want to live there. Because the first thing they'll do is take away all of those privileges that you use to dismantle the world that we built.
Right. So they know it, too. That's the funniest thing. They know it,
but they don't.
Just recently there was a proof of that. You know what I mean? The triangle communities.
With the Trump plan.
Flipped out. They were
hey, you guys want to live in Palestine? We're happy to just move the border. What?
Hell no. We do not want to live in Palestine. that Arab psychology, at the end, it's like...
It's human psychology. The Arabs have their own bent on it. It's for sure the whole honor-shame culture is a big problem with them. But it's also human psychology. It's like everybody wants to have their cake and eat it too.
Nobody
wants to own their problems and actually fix it. We as the Jews, God promised us that this isn't going to end until we get it right. And so we've stuck it out. And so we have a much deeper sense of like, okay, well... I hear you. You have all those good
things.
You have
right next to the Arabs, you have another group of people called the Druze, and they run a totally different life.
Who are very unique people.
I'm not sure that they're... I think the Arabs are the ones who are unique, because the Druze, they basically run a simple software in their head, which is called loyalty. And the Arabs, they run a software in their head, which is called jihad. One way or the other. It could be religious or secular jihad.
But you realize that the Druze loyalty came into being in response to the Arab jihad. I mean, they were a people that broke away from the Arabs. And the only way that they could find... They had to flee, literally, to the highest hilltops. That's why people are probably unaware that you find the Druze on the highest... I was just at the Hermon. Right? I was in the Nimrod, the highest Jewish... you know, place in land of Israel. Why? Because the Druze are still holding the highest high ground.
Right.
Because they had to run away from the Arabs in order to live. And so they realized, as a minority amongst the Arabs, their only way to survive was loyalty. Those two came into being together. Well, the Arab thing.
I think that the Arabs have been conquerors and bullies for a long time.
They're the worst. They're conquerors and bullies who got whooped.
Right. and so now they're playing, the psychology here is like to play the victim instead of being what you really are, which is the aggressor, and it's thanklessness and it's foolishness, and at the end of the day, it's really quite frustrating. But it's also dumb of us to have given them, let's put it this way, I'll put it in your language, to have given them the vote without responsibilities.
Yes, that was
absurd.
But that's why I go back to that point, and that proves true, by the way, in all sectors of our society. Why is Lieberman sticking a finger in the eye of a right-wing government for the last three elections? Because he thinks the same way about the Haredim. He said it was dumb of us to give them the vote without the responsibilities. There's more to it than that.
You know,
I know that, but
he is not such an ideologue.
I understand.
He's been in bed with the Haredim his whole life.
But can you deny that that is at least the energy he has rallied.
No, that's what he's rallied.
But that bespeaks something within Israeli society, which is a problem as well.
You know, they've done research on the amount of funding that the state gives to Russian communities as opposed to Haredi communities. And it turns out that the Russian communities have more social welfare needs than the Haredi communities.
Okay.
Okay. So, okay, they don't go to the army. But in terms of just raw cost to the state, you're immigrants, and I'm part of those people, but like, your immigrant class that you get to vote for you, you know, you make it look like they're the, you know, great contributors, the Haredim or the bloodsuckers, but that's just simply not true. On top of it, he himself was reliant on these people for a long time, and he turned his back on everybody. His problem is one thing: he's a wrecker. He is not a builder. He has no record of building. And there are two kinds of people in this world: builders and wreckers. Netanyahu could say whatever you want about him, but he's a builder.
Do you see once again the parallel to the Arabs of Israel? Do you see again the parallel? It's like this posture of wanting something and not having to give in return goes together with people who are never going to build. Right? And in the Haredi world, for all the world of Torah it's built, has not invested in building the state in the way it could. You know? And
but they're building. They're building yeshivas, they're building families, they're building buildings, and they built economy. You know, their own.
I mean, the Arabs are growing too. I mean, listen, this episode I just released says in 1960 there were 250,000 Israeli Arabs. Now we're looking at probably 1.5 million. I don't exactly know the number. Mm-hmm. Right, like, that's the big joke you've seen it on social media, right? Worst jihad or worst genocide ever, right? You know, so there is, of course, that side of growth, but what lacks here is the invested national vision, and I think that it's a critical testing ground. Are you willing to put your cards into this national pile? In which case, yes, then we will take the risk of enfranchising you to make decisions in it. Are you not? We hold values of civil liberties. We hold values of economic freedom. So therefore, just by virtue of the grace of God, by the way, that put you in our borders, we'll give you that. But not if you're not willing to buy into the national story, then you can't.
Well,
you know, make the rules.
In order to do what you're recommending here, it's going to take a big change.
Oh yeah,
and the truth is that big change. I wouldn't say it's coming. But I would say the rumblings underneath, what do you call those, pre-earthquakes? Those
tremors.
The tremors are here.
Yeah.
And
I have a question for you. Do you want this government to work out this round, or do you want a fourth of the round?
I want it to work out.
I want it to fail.
Okay.
Because this crisis has to get deeper.
Right.
And that's why I said, in the end of the day, 15... I appreciate the fact that the Arabs have succeeded in saying, hey, folks, we're not going away. Now, they may not be pleased with the response they get, but I think it's important. Stop sleeping, people. Stop pretending. When the Arabs had 6 votes, 10 votes, we could just say, who cares? 15. They're the third largest party right now.
That's right.
Wake up.
That's right.
Smell the coffee. Whatever it is you decide to do.
Right. And their thing is going to be to just stick a stick in the spokes. That's all they're going to
do.
They're not going to, you know, move forward. Although, by the way, interestingly enough, the number one issue that the Israeli Arab voters are asking for is, ironically, help. Listen to this. Because it also fits into the whole story here. The Israeli Arab voters are asking their parties to help with the spread of violence in the Arab communities, especially gun violence.
Yes.
So they want the state to defang their own societies and take away the arms because the arms are turning against them.
But that's the proof of the failure of their leaders.
Right.
Because if their leaders weren't politicized, you know what would happen? I'll tell you exactly what happened. You would have a social justice government between Kahol Levan, Shas, the Arabs, and whoever else wanted to join, UTJ. It would be a social justice government. They would fight violence in the Arab communities. They'd work, help the poor, racial issues, and it would have no political narrative at all. And that could be a strong government, but it'll never happen.
Right.
Because like you pointed out, the leadership of the Arab world is too politicized right now.
Right. Okay, so no, I mean what you said just now about wanting the current government effort to fail is a powerful
not wanting.
I understand, but seeing the advantage of it of such a thing happening, it's a powerful tale that you're weaving here, and
it's quite seasonal.
Right, there are moments in time of, you know, let's say like 1917 where like World War One was finished, and so the powers got together and they were trying to reform the world and create a League of Nations and to cut up, you know, old huge empires and to cut them down to, you know, into its minor parts. And then at the same time, the communist revolution, and then at the same time, the birth of the idea of Israel. Like, there are these ripe moments in time.
Yep.
It may be that we're entering such a ripe moment. Ripe moments are scary, like birth.
Oh, yeah.
Like, birth is scary. And also, great things come out of them, and some crappy things come out of them.
For sure.
And that's exactly...
You just hope it takes a step upwards.
Right. Like the European fake countries that were created here in the Middle East in that era were bad things.
Yeah, and okay? They're falling apart all around us.
Right, they're falling apart because they're fake.
Yeah, they're just fake.
They're fake. And Jordan, the fakest of them all, the fakest country of them all, is still around because everybody wants to see it stay up.
And which is why we need to just start pushing on that button. We just need to start pushing on
no,
it.
You know, nobody wants that because the America-Israel alliance, it's the American who are all concerned
about
it.
As far as I'm concerned, it would be worth losing that alliance to bring that down.
Well, like what you're talking about is putting, there's a great Hebrew word, muskamot, like social contracts
right.
into the blender.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you hope it comes out a nice milkshake.
Oh, yeah.
But it could also come out not as a nice milkshake.
But you know what the flip side is?
I mean, I could dig it. I could hear it at least.
Worship
you know?
Of the status quo, yeah. If you really believe that the situation is in its heart not stable,
right.
is the equivalent of welding the lid on a pot while leaving it on a boiling stove.
Right.
Eventually, what will happen is it will just explode.
Right.
Right, and that's what I see around us is that anybody who thinks that like higanu ad l'menucha, right, that we finally arrived in the nachal menucha in that biblical sense we've achieved either has a very low bar for what Am Yisrael is trying to achieve in the world or isn't paying attention to the situation. We're not there, man, and therefore by my eyes, by definition, there's major change coming. I don't worship.
I don't know about the word by definition. I don't know about that. I'm sensitive to the word by definition, but there is.
I'm talking prophetic definition right, okay. of what we've inherited from our forefathers. That the voice of God that has come through our people for thousands of years. That's what I mean when I say by definition. We ain't there.
And yet, on the other hand, we live in an era of great bourgeoisie.
That's one of the big barriers.
It's a huge barrier. And yet it is nice.
It's great. Dude. I just took a two-day vacation. Right, like, exactly. Come on. I was driving a massive rental car.
And I don't mean bourgeoisie in the material sense. I mean it like there's time to contemplate and enjoy.
Good.
Life is good. And grow in Torah and go into the Temple Mount, etc.
Yeah.
Okay. So we shall see because what you're I wouldn't say, I don't know if advocating is the right word, but what you're kind of envisioning here is a not exactly evolutionary, but somewhat revolutionary.
A bit more revolutionary.
It's between it's between evolution and revolution.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is if you actually study evolution, there are two models. There's mm-hmm. the classic evolution posed to revolution you're speaking about, which is right. the gradualist. You know, slowly things change.
Right.
But the reality of how evolution functions, if you actually look at the fossil record, is what's called punctuated equilibrium,
mm-hmm.
which is that periodically there's massive change.
Right.
Asteroid hits off the Yucatan and suddenly all those little gerbils that were scurrying under the rocks are sending rockets to the moon, right? Meaning the way in which life actually changes in the evolutionary pattern is, okay, slowly, but boom,
right.
And then everything reorders. Like you yourself pointed out.
Yeah. Maybe
human history.
Maybe caterpillar to butterfly.
It's called punctuated equilibrium.
Right. I mean, a caterpillar becomes a butterfly. It is dramatic.
Yes.
It's revolutionary, well, but yet it's part of evolution.
Well, yes. Meaning there's one moment which the expressed form is no longer identifiably connected to what preceded it.
Right.
But the will that runs through them both is the
mm-hmm.
same.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we as a people have to keep a track of,
mm-hmm.
is that in the same way that our holy ancestors who ran in the fields with David HaMelech might not recognize you and I. As soon as we started a conversation,
right.
they would be able to say, unbelievable.
Right.
We made it.
That's right.
You know? So, but that thread has to be nurtured.
And there are and stories built. Like that. There is, I think, a Gemara like that, which is the kind of famous Gemara where Moshe Rabbeinu sees Rabbi Akiva, and he's like, what is he doing? You know what I mean?
I don't get it.
What's
the Torah he's teaching? Yeah. And what's Rabbi Akiva say at the end? When one of his students asks him, like, Rabbi, where did you learn this from? He says, it's Torah Moshe Mitzrayim.
Right.
This is Torah from Moshe at Sinai. Moshe's comforted in that moment.
Right.
Because he realizes that what he's bringing down is actually too big for him to know.
Right. Right.
And that he can trust the future that he has children like Rabbi Akiva. That's our task.
Okay. All right. You know, just for me personally, just having kind of been involved.
You were in the center of it.
Like in all of these giant Jewish, Israel, America, global conversations, including P.S., not the small thing of flying through and back through Corona.
Yeah.
You know, that whole, like, I'll tell you about Corona for a second.
Best with lime, serve cold. Yeah. Corona. Sorry, it's an old joke, but it never really
You make
dies.
That joke. But we're gonna remind me to talk about it during the part with Malka, because there's a Corona Mishloach Manot that's about to come out.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's really funny. It's like a Corona beer and a mask and the gloves.
Oh,
okay?
That's great.
Yeah. So, but like I'm flying the airplane. On the way there, I really flew with a mask and the whole spiel.
Yeah, it's all pictures.
And I thought to myself, oh, this is like bubonic plague. This is like those times in human history where this evil disease spreads throughout and kills thousands.
With the fortunate exception of the fact that the bubonic plague wiped out half the population of Europe, coronavirus is not that deadly.
Correct. But the feeling.
The feeling, yeah.
The feeling.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, we're not totally in charge of everything.
Uh-huh.
Oh, there's this thing which is also viral. The word virality right. seems like it has
the
taken.
The coronavirus has gone viral.
It's
People
almost
said
like,
that.
It's almost like it took some an idea from the internet of spreading really far.
So I'll tell you what it looks like to go viral.
You know, and I was just like, oh, we're human. We're little pipsqueak ants, and there's this like weird disease that's spreading throughout. Also, by the way, another thing about coronavirus. Here's another thing that you can't really say today. Can you say to the Chinese, "Hey guys"? I am not saying that God punished you because of X. I am not saying that. But what I am saying is that God prescribed certain health measures, certain ways of eating, and you should consider them, and you should also consider doing a little bit of tshuva, some human tshuva.
Yeah, because okay? If you weren't eating bats,
right.
This might not have broken out.
Right. And if also maybe your behavior wouldn't be so aggressive about the world, about economy, about subduing your own people, all that stuff.
I mean, if they hadn't kept the secret and tried to like not tell anyone, etc.
All the stuff that they do. They do a lot of bad stuff.
Yeah,
they do a lot of bad
it's
stuff.
It's not a good society.
Right. They do a lot of bad stuff in that society, and we've seen the pictures and all this stuff, and it's just like it's time to eat more normally. And it's time to do a little tshuva and become a little bit more human.
Yeah.
And like, can Israel say such phrases? Israel, a moral compass in this world.
Right.
You know what I mean? Ostensibly.
Right.
Will it say to Iran?
Well, will it and can it is are two different questions.
Right. Will it say to Iran, Allah is against what you're doing? Will it say to China, you know, you should do a little tshuva here. You should think about this. You should do tshuva in your eating. You should become a little bit more, come back down to... Don't be such a middle kingdom. Come down a little bit.
I'll tell you one thing is that whether we will or not, I can say that our ability to succeed in doing it is going to demand from us holding ourselves to the highest moral standard. And there's a lot of work to be done within our own society. Like,
yeah.
Not that it makes what you're saying untrue. It just means that it's too easy for the world not to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why God, in addition to all those health measures you're talking about, demanded of us such a high standard of behavior because the world needs a moral compass.
42 minutes into the show, it's time to get to a little bit of Torah. We have
that hurts. You mean something more specifically textual?
Yeah, what I mean to say is let us see if the actual Torah can shine a light on the questions that we're asking.
No question in my mind.
Right? And we have a Torah portion of Tetzaveh, which is, it has a lot to do with Purim in two ways. Really, one is that Moses' name is absent from the whole Torah portion. This is the one Torah portion since the introduction of Moses that Moses' name is absent.
True.
It's totally absent. In fact, the star of the show ostensibly is Aaron and his sons and the vestments that are going to be donned upon him. And we really get, for the first time, if you think about it, we really get a kind of image of a human what is a person supposed to look like? We never know what Abraham looks like. We never know what Noah looked like. We don't know what really Moses looked like. We don't really have anything tactile to kind of feel. Suddenly we're getting a real image of this human being dressed in a godly idea. Maybe like from, it's like the first time a little bit from like Garden of Eden. It's like, remember he dressed them. Now he's dressing Aaron and we get a real picture of that thing.
And yet we don't ever know what his face looks like.
Right.
We know how he's dressed. And it's so important what you're saying because these vestments, the Shmona Begadim, the garments of the Kohen Gadol, Right? In many ways, they parallel the construction of the Mishkan, the tabernacle. There's a lot of discussion around how each element of the tabernacle reflects some sort of aspect of the relationship between God and creation, it's a spiritual truths, etc. It sometimes is missed that the eight garments of the Kohen Gadol function in the same way. And what's most important is this is what a Kohen looks like. Well, I got news for you. Who are meant to be the Kohanim of the world before the giving of the Ten Commandments? God said it very expressly that we tiuli mamlecha Kohanim v'goy kadosh. You will be for me a kingdom of Kohanim, of priests. So there's something in each of these begadim, as you say, that show us how Am Yisrael should look in the world.
Right.
Right. This is how a mensch, to go back to the right. Church, this is how a mensch is supposed to look in the world.
A mensch is a very interesting word because it's a very important kind of Jewish word, and it really means a man.
Yep.
And a, you know, it really means like a mensch, like a person.
But when you say be a mensch, what are you saying? I said to my son on this trip more than once. Right. It means like, yeah, you could be the animal side of what it is to be a human being, the biological side.
Right.
But you could also be a mensch. You could be that which you're capable of being. Right. Which is this moment, like you're saying. This is all built up to this moment. Now Aaron's going to take these vestments and he's going to go in the most inner place and connect heaven and earth.
Right.
But only with that capacity can you connect heaven and earth.
We also have two. So we have the vestments. We also have two vessels. One is the – and it's interesting that the it's bookmarked – bookended, excuse me,
yep.
On the Torah portion with the menorah in the beginning, and it's the fine – refined oil that is to be lit in the morning, and then at the end it's the golden
incense altar.
The golden incense altar with the crown. I talked about the three crowns last week's show, but it's got this crown, and so you have these really very spiritual ideas. You have the light. It's right. Not even the menorah. It's the light of the menorah. It's the fire of the menorah. And then the incense at the very end, it bookends this human being, as you said, kind of faceless, but on the other hand, with a lot of godly personality.
Well, not only the facelessness is indicative of the fact that by wearing those clothes, you become the Kohen. I mean, it says expressly, one of the ways in which there, of course, was the anointing oil, but the anointing oil at a certain point in history gets lost. So how did the later Kohanim become the head Kohen, the Kohen Gadol? You put the vestments on them, which again is a message. Is that this is, you want to become the priest who connects heaven and earth, you need to put these things on. Why is it bookended by those two particular tools of service,
which are the more they're not the sac. There is also sacrifices in this week's Torah portion, but the bookends are not the sacrificial ones.
Correct.
They're the ones that kind of you get a sense that they'll keep going forever. This idea,
they have an expression elsewhere in our practice,
right.
But they're also the more refined.
Right.
There's a particular avoda, a particular spiritual practice, which is associated with both the menorah and the golden altar and nothing else, which is hatava, right? The hatava tanerot. I'm not going to translate it right now. The something of the candles. And when you make the incense, you say hedek, hetev, hetev, hedek, right? You grind it hetev. It's a goodening of it.
Right.
Now, what does that mean? It's a readying. The lamps, you ready them so that just a spark.
Right.
And they'll burn. Incense, same way. You get it perfectly fine and well-mixed so that you just drop one coal.
Wow,
it all comes out. Right? And you see that's the avoda of a Kohen.
Just a thought for everybody listening. Like, the Gemara says that women of Jerusalem would not wear perfume because the scent of the Ketoret was it so enveloped all of Jerusalem that it would, like, it would mess it up. You didn't want to put on that perfume.
Said goats down in Jericho would sneeze that the smell was so strong, which is one of my favorite images. It's like you're out in the guys out in the shepherds out in the pasture, and the goats also going,
yeah,
yeah. Oh, they must have just done the incense.
That's right. And if you do have a guy in shul that brings the tobacco, and you little snuff, and you do the sneeze in the shul, that remembers that
think of yourself as a Jericho goat.
Jericho goats. That's right, Jericho goats. Man. And now we gotta get to the Megillat Esther, because this is the pre-Purim show. So we have to touch it. And I did prepare last night quite a bit, so I wanted to touch some points here. First thing is that we talk about the Keter Malchut. We talk about the
crown of kingship.
Who wears the crown of kingship? Well, first Vashti is going to be asked to put on the crown of kingship.
Right.
ostensibly only the crown of kingship,
right,
not anything else. But she was to wear it really in the nude to show kind of Persian, Greek kind of beauty.
Remembering that the sages say that she is the daughter, or perhaps granddaughter, I can't remember quite, of Belshazzar, meaning she's the last member of the Babylonian kingdom,
that's right,
that took that crown away from Am Yisrael,
mm-hmm,
by, right, destroying the temple.
Right.
When we were wearing God's crown. And so therefore, there's a very important moment there of trying, right, to get her to don that crown in the nude to show the Persian power.
Right. And she also, it says in the Rashi, that she forced her maidens, her Jewish maidens, she under servitude, she forced them to work naked on the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. So she, in turn, was forced to come kind of naked on the Sabbath. The other thing that is mentioned about the crown is the horse. The horse that Haman says, let's get it ready for
whoever it is the king wants to honor.
Whoever the king wants to honor, which is ostensibly me, right?
Because who else would the, right, king be thinking of,
right,
says Haman.
And when he says that, the sages say that Ahasuerus' face changed. He realized that Haman wants the crown.
Right.
Right? Or what he said, and another take is, what did he mean by crown on a horse? Now, it turns out that in Persian times, horses did wear these crowns, these kind of crowns. But another way of saying it is, you're calling me a horse.
Right.
You're saying I'm controlled. And it turns out, if you read the text, that Ahasuerus, the king of Persia, is a constantly controlled person.
Yeah.
He almost makes no decisions on his own. He's constantly being recommended things, and he's swayed, and then he's upset. They give him another piece of
Doesn't
advice.
Every powerful advisor look at the person behind whom they stand really as just a vehicle for their own plans.
Isn't that a wife looks on a husband?
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean, that's a classic relationship there too, right? But meaning Haman slips up in that moment,
right,
by revealing his deeper relationship as he sees it.
Right. Another thing is the very amazing statement that the sages say is that, do you remember the first laws that came out from Ahasuerus to the kingdom? He said, every man should rule his house.
Right.
And speak
his own
language. And the sages say that if it wasn't for the dumbness of the initial laws, they saved the Jewish people, because people would have accepted the second laws, which were destroy the Jews.
Right.
People would have bought into it, but they were like,
This is the same guy that just told me I'm allowed, yeah, to speak my own language in my house.
This is a nutty king.
Yeah.
This is a nutty king. And by the way, I see parallels to that here in Israel with Benny Gantz. I think that Benny Gantz lost the vote in part because he was just a bad communicator. And you thought, yeah, to yourself, this is a bumbling fool.
He comes, okay, across as a bumbling,
right,
fool. And he doesn't have the Rabin stolid silence thing, because,
right,
he tries to compete with Bibi on his turf and fails miserably.
You can't compete with one of the best communicators of all time,
no
and
way,
be a less than moderate communicator.
Yeah.
Medium communicator. Like, right, you know, not
but I think he just lacks the integrity to just then be quiet.
Right. He doesn't do that. So, too, in America right now, you've got this Joe Biden. I've watched him a few times now, and I've got to tell you something.
It's painful.
The guy is senile. He's partially senile. For God's sakes, does anybody not see this? The guy's senile. And I'm not talking about his opinions. I'm not talking about what he stands for.
Just
what he does.
In his way he speaks.
Right. He doesn't have it. And he's going up against Trump. What a joke.
Who, for all his wackiness, is an effective communicator.
I sat about 30 yards from him as he gave an hour and 20-minute long speech, which was a tour de force.
You love him, hate him, agree, right, or not, he's an effective communicator.
Certainly an effective, really not even just everything from off script,
right,
to on script,
meaning sometimes it comes across like, wait, what just happened, that was really weird,
yeah,
but it works,
yeah,
somehow.
It works. So what were we saying just now, that the dumbness of laws,
right,
like people don't trust leadership that says stupid things,
for sure. Which opens up a very dangerous vacuum, don't forget, is that this is one of the things we face in our country right now, is that, thank God, the percentage of voting apparently went up even a little bit more.
Yes.
You know, but there's that danger that lurks, is that people really give
up. It went up a bunch.
You went a bunch? I know it went up a little.
It went up quite a bunch.
That's such good news.
It was very high voting. It was one of the highest votings ever recorded in Israel's history. It was practically 70% voting.
That's such good news.
And I mean, America would be jealous of this voting.
Yeah, but that's one of the reasons, of course, that the Arab vote came up so high, because they got
and
out
the
Likud vote.
And the Likud
vote,
vote
for
and the
sure.
Vote.
For
and
sure.
What went down was the Tel Aviv vote.
Right, because they're the ones that are the ennui. They're like, ugh, government. This is like
maybe
not,
they were just disappointed
me.
In their guy.
Well, they, you know,
maybe they thought that their guy or their horse wasn't so great.
Yeah, at some point you got to back a horse.
Here's another thing I found yesterday, which I thought was very, very interesting and kind of new to me, just a tad, which was it said that you know, very famously it says that she wouldn't reveal her nation. But I found the Rashi. Speaking of Esther, and I found the Rashi. The Rashi said that she didn't reveal that she was from royalty, that she was from a royal line. Mm-hmm. That was a big thing.
From the house of Shaul.
Right, because had she revealed that, then they would have detained her more and would have been interested more in that marriage.
And she couldn't have moved below the radar like she did.
Right.
She wasn't a threat at all to Ahasuerus.
Right. That's right.
And she was able to, therefore, and don't miss, of course, that the critical moment for Esther, after Mordechai tells her about the decree and she says, oh, I don't know, I can't go before the king without risking my life, and he says, listen, this is the moment, take it or leave it, and they all fast, it says she's loveshet malchut.
Right.
She dons royalty.
Right.
So in that moment, you have this sense that she's been holding herself back since day one. She didn't tell anyone she's from.
Right.
But, you know, royalty will out, as they say. Meaning, like, she wasn't your average.
Is that a phrase?
Yeah, like, you know, you just, in the idea being that, you know, all those folk tales about, like, the prince who's kidnapped and is, you know, but there's some element of breeding, of culture, maybe even you want to go into the genetics thing, I don't even need to go there, but just the way in which you are doesn't match the world around you. You have a sense of vision.
I have met some people that are from type of royal lines, and they bear it. They bear it out.
By the way, here we are sitting with Ptil Techelet. Right. One of the reasons that if we could go so far as to say God's reasons, one of the understandings that we have of why a Jew is meant to wear this blue string is because this is the color of royalty. So therefore, even if you're a simple farmer, you know, plowing the fields of the Galil, or you're some guy, I don't know, packing meat right now in Rehovot or wherever, like, just remember, look down and see, you are royalty. And therefore, it's not a privilege, like, be egoistic. No, you need to carry yourself as such.
It's funny you say this, because I just realized that on the flight over, and I flew United. For the purposes of Zionism, I left El Al for this trip, and I flew with United.
In order to be back here in time to vote?
Right. So I left El Al.
Good. You didn't go with the formalist Zionism. We went to the real one.
Right. I went for voting. And I must say that I missed El Al very much. Our mutual friend Zev says, you know, it's like, that's like home, you know, that's your home. That's your home airline.
Latova the Mutav.
Yeah, no, and I missed it. And you know, and the only thing was that on United, there was some excellent TV, and I did get to watch on the way there and the way back. I didn't watch 1 minute of TV. On the way there, I watched two documentaries, which were quite interesting, really quite interesting documentaries. One about technology, one actually about sports, weirdly enough, but it was about Russians being brought over to Detroit to play. Anyway, whatever. It was interesting about the Russian-America thing.
Royalty.
Right, royalty. Speaking of royalty, Haman made himself into a god, according to Rashi. Not that he was wearing the god.
Little idol on his chest.
Little idol. But the reason that Mordechai wouldn't bow to him is because he portrayed himself as a god. And because Jews do bow down.
Yeah.
There's bows of greeting. There's all kinds of bows. But
bowing to a king is a reasonable thing.
Right.
It's real power. We recognize power.
But somebody who makes himself into an idol and into a powerful god. Now, also Rashi mentions famously that at some point, and this is very just a great backstory, that Haman and Mordechai were both generals in the army. And at some point, Haman's troops ran out of food. And he had to make a deal with Mordechai. And so Mordechai wrote on a shoe that forever Haman is a servant to Mordechai.
Right.
So he would show him the shoe. He would show him the shoe, and that would make him kind of crazy. And that's why it says, like, every time I see Mordechai, I go kind of crazy.
I've got everything, but it's not worth it to me as long as he's around.
Okay, so let's just talk about two more things, and then we're done. The Tao Te Ching, which I've mentioned a few times, is I think one of the smartest books outside of Torah world, is the Tao Te Ching.
A lot of wisdom.
Lots of awesome wisdom, and it says something like sometimes you have to allow something to go big before it can kind of disappear from this world. And I know this is going to sound a little gross, but I very much think of a zit. Like sometimes a zit has to get big before it can be popped and then go away.
Things have to go through their process.
Right. Like sometimes and so sometimes you can't get it at an inception.
Oh, by the way, that's what I meant before, is that worshiping the status quo is just standing in the way of something which has to play itself out.
Right. Right. So some things have to come to a head, yeah, as they say.
Hence the zit metaphor.
Right, the zit metaphor. Now speaking of zits, she brings Haman. Esther brings Haman she brings him in. She brings him up.
Yeah.
She brings him way up. And not only that, the simple reading and also the sage's reading is that she makes Ahasuerus nervous about Haman.
Yeah.
Is Haman and Esther a thing?
Well, think
are
about
they,
it.
Are they going to plot against
it's
getting
bad
with
enough
the king?
He's the advisor. Yeah, it's exactly. As soon as he's got the queen on his side, it's
right.
Like there's like a real danger here. Like
and Ahasuerus himself is not from a deep lineage. Yeah. He can be offed.
Yeah, he knows the history.
Right? So he understands that. And but the to me the courage of bringing the bad guy close, bringing him really close.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then frontally attacking him by bringing him very close. That's it's like who was the judge who stuck the knife in the
Ehud.
Ehud, he stuck the knife in
right in the gut of
the corpulent king there.
Yeah, he's blanking on his name. Yeah,
right. But so like you got to come close. Sometimes you got to bring the enemy close.
Yeah, no, it's really true that there is a necessity, but that demands both an emuna, like a real deep faith, and also a willingness to act.
Yeah,
you can't balk when your enemy's far away. You can dither. You can balk. You can twiddle your thumbs and consider your options.
Right.
You bring in your enemy close, it means it's only going to end one way.
Right. The game is on. The game is afoot.
Yeah. See that 50-foot high tree over there?
Right.
One of us is going to be hanging from there
right.
before this story is over.
That's courage.
Well, listen, and it's a lot, I think, of what the Purim story needs to teach us now, at the risk of sounding even more militant than I did before. So there comes a time in every person's life and in every people's history where you have to make some decisions because they're going to happen whether you make them or not.
Right.
But what you're pointing out is the way you do that is by a very deep engagement with specifically that which opposes you.
Right. That's big stuff. That's big stuff. Okay, and this will bring me into right into the landing of the end here. Haman comes into his house after having the
first banquet.
No, after the first banquet. When did they say Napoleon Napoleon Napoleon? They tell him, oh.
No, it's after he rides Mordechai
right.
around
he rides
on a horse.
Mordechai on the horse, right?
Before the first banquet.
Right. He rides Mordechai on the horse before the first banquet.
And he comes back and he gathers Zeresh and all his advisors.
No, it's after the first banquet.
The banquets happen back to back.
Oh, they happen back to back? Okay.
He rides Mordechai around on the horse. He comes back, gathers his advisors, and says, Kol ze eneno shoveli.
Right.
It's not worth it to me. And there's the first banquet.
No,
and
but
the
then they say hang him, right? They say prepare to hang him.
Right.
Then he goes, all right. All right, wait a second. I got a little bit confused. So anyway, he.
Well, I just want to say, I could be wrong.
It's okay. The bottom line is this: he comes into his family. Haman comes to his family, and he's like, "Whoa, things are starting to go back. I look like I'm the one who's riding. I was supposed to be on top of the horse. I'm actually the guy before the horse. Mordechai is beloved. I'm starting to fade here.
Yep.
The Medrash says that his daughter threw the bucket."
On his
feces
head.
On his head, and she herself then threw herself from the window. Things are starting to turn
go
the other way. His family says to him, "If from the seed of the Jews is Mordechai, you can't stop it. You will surely fall before him."
Right.
Right. Now, I say this every year, but the Al Sheikh writes an explanation on this, which is unbelievable. He says, no. They gave him real advice. They didn't just say, oh, you're done for. They gave him real advice. He says, Im yiser Yehudi Mordechai, Yehudi asher hachilot ha'lipon farav. If indeed he is Mordechai, he's from the Jews, see, there's a way to defeat him. How? Napol nafolti fanav. Just bow down. Say you're sorry. Go for the embrace.
Right.
Say that you're a friend. Say it was a misunderstanding.
Because then he won't go all the way with it.
Right, because the Jews are weak on this point.
Yeah.
They, if you're starting to fall before him, just apologize.
Well, you know, that's all the way back to the Tanakh, Malchei Rachamim.
Right.
Right? They're merciful kings. They'll let you go.
And that's how our forefather Agag made
it. Survived.
Yeah, he's like, come on. We could do it better. You know, you're right. You win.
The war's over.
The war's over. You know
I
what
lost.
I mean? Let's come to a detente. You know, only enemies can make peace. You know what I mean? The strong, the brave make peace. You know that business? And so the advice is, no. Suck up. suck up and embrace the Jew. Don't go tight. Don't go hard. Say, I didn't know. Say, I was only following orders. Ooh. You know what I mean? Say, right. You could say stuff. You know
say
what I mean?
Whatever you need to.
You don't say, Heil Hitler all the way.
Right.
Just be like, oh, gosh, that guy was crazy. I didn't know. Yeah. I don't know what seized me. I don't know what
happened.
And we'll
let it go.
Right. We'll let it go because the Jews are soft like that. And indeed, that's what he does. He apologizes at that moment. He says, I was misunderstood. He falls on the bed. He's all apologetic. Right?
Right.
But no. They don't let up this time.
Esther doesn't.
Right. Esther doesn't. And in the end, they even hang his, after the 10 sons are killed, they still hang him. They've gone like hardcore. What did you say before? Militant.
Yeah.
The Jews went militant on Purim.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right.
It is the militant holiday.
Wait. So that's the tricky way to defeat the Jews. And then I wanted to connect it to something. And now because of the rush, I forgot. How do we connect that to the end here?
I mean, on some level, it's a call to understand that if you have a desire for Malchut, for this crown, mm-hmm. not for yourself, but for God, let's not forget whose crown it really is,
right.
that there comes a time at which you need to overcome that very genuine and important aspect within Am Yisrael, because if you're holding your enemy close and they're truly your enemy, mm-hmm. then there's really only one thing to be done.
Right.
And in that case, mercy might be the biggest mistake you could make.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's how I would bring it in.
Have a determination, a clarity of vision. What we always talk about, a clarity of vision.
Right, right. Because just like you wanted to name the show,
Remember to Forget.
Remember to Forget. You also have to, you know, like, you know, the sort of like, don't forget to remember. Right? Like, there's a
remember
certain
to forget.
Well, because what happens is in that moment, we forget about.
Right.
All the hard and the evil. We want to move beyond it and let it go. And why burden ourselves? But like, just like we have a commandment to sort of like, you have to forget to remember, or you have to remember to forget. Sorry. It's also like, don't forget to remember. Mm-hmm. That's the tension in Amalek because it's written in the Torah.
Right.
Right. Don't forget. You're supposed to forget. So we're supposed to remember. It's complicated, but the answer in the end of the day is that we and Amalek cannot be in this world together. Mm-hmm.
And yet, on Purim,
and you drink a little bit. Okay, well, we didn't get to the depth of Purim. I'm putting out a good Purim show. I want you to listen to it this year. I've got willing to record it tomorrow.
Good. I'm looking forward to that. And that's found at JewishStory.co or here on the Land of Israel Network.
Quickest way to find us on Facebook.
Facebook is Facebook.com/Rav Mike. And you can email Rabbi Mike at RavMike@thelandofIsrael.com. Ishai at thelandofisrael.com, IshaiFleischer.com. Easy enough. And we wish you a great and awesome Purim.
Mamash, you should move beyond.
That's right, beyond. Have a place where you understand everything and then have a place where you understand nothing.
That's right.
And that's part of
Purim.
And when
you wake up in the morning, try to remember which was which.
Or don't even bother, right?
Yeah.
Or don't even bother and just keep going because life is amazing. God is in charge. He's got a great dream. Yes, we got to push it forward, but don't worry. He's still the boss and he's got it going on. I think that's underneath it all. That's one of the great lessons of Purim.
Amen.
Rabbi Mike, thank you so much for being with me. Happy Shabbat Zachor. Remember to forget this Shabbat Zachor.
I won't forget to remember to forget.
That's right. And we'll be back with Malka Fleischer, of course, the immutable Malka Fleischer. That's her radio nickname.
Immutable.
The immutable. The immutable.
Think about that one.
The immutable Malka Fleischer. The indefatigable immutable Malka Fleischer.
I would certainly never try to mute Malka.
Yeah,
that would just end poorly.
That's what I'm saying. It's just she's immutable. And she's on next here on the Land of Israel Network on the Ishai Fleischer Show. Stay tuned. God bless you. Happy Purim, Rabbi Mike. Shabbat Shalom.
Oh, Shabbat Shalom.
While we're facing a threat of an endemic disease, we conducted a whole election. Nothing can stop our Jewish democratic state. We want to have a say in the future of the Jewish people that is being written as we speak. We are in the glory days of the Jewish people, and even more glorious days are yet to come because of the strength that the Jewish people showed in this election.
Listen to Inside Israel Today with Gil Hoffman, political correspondent for the Jerusalem Post, every week on thelandofisrael.com.
Shalom, and welcome back to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting this segment from Judea, and we're in the home of Malka Fleischer. Malka, shalom, and welcome to the show.
Hey, Yishai.
You're a tad ill. I'm a tad.
I do not believe it is corona related.
No, you have a cold.
But I have just like a cold, although I will tell you, and I guess probably a lot of people out there listening can relate to this, you get like a cold. And it's a cold where you're like, on any other given day, you'd just be like, oh, I got a cold. But now you're like, oh, my God. Is this it?
Oh, yeah. There was.
Is this it? Is this my moment? Do I have to call an authority? Do I have to go to a doctor? Do I have to call a hotline?
Right. Do you have to be quarantined?
Right. Like, is this like am I a public health nuisance?
Yeah. I was on the plane on the way back. On the way to the United States, I was very careful and I wore the mask and everything. On the way back, nobody else was wearing a mask. Plus, I was tired, and I just sat down.
So, if everyone else jumps off the Brooklyn Bridge, are you going to jump too?
No, but that's what happened. And I did wipe the chair and the screen and everything with the
alcohol wipes that your wife provided for you so diligently.
Correct.
I did carefully.
That's right. I did that, and then. But at the same time, at the end of the flight, I saw a friend of mine, like an acquaintance of mine, and she was sick. On the plane, she was wearing a mask trying to contain it. Anyway, I was just like, oh, and I said to her, Corona? And she was like, I don't know.
See,
like
some that's a tiny bit where I am. Like, right. My daughter, the beautiful Kiai Nahara, Leah Batzion, she had a cold. A straight up cold with throat, with snot, you know, all the regular stuff. And I knew that she was going to give me this cold. Right. And because she relentlessly breathes on me without any
remorse,
kind of guilt or effort whatsoever. So then I got this cold. But even still, niggling in the back of my mind is this like, oh my God, like, I don't know. Sicknesses are so scary right now.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that, and I was talking about this with Rabbi Mike, it's medieval. It's medieval and it's...
Right.
And
we're actually very blessed. You know, I mean, this coronavirus, it's dangerous.
You know what the real danger of it is?
But the truth is, Yishai, if this had been 50 years ago even, but certainly 150 years ago, then like this would be a very deeply scary illness.
Yeah. But the illness is having... However, while what you said is true in terms of life and death, in terms of health, in terms of economic health, today it's having tremendous ripples.
Right.
And it's having ripples on the stock market and tourism.
Oh my gosh, are you kidding? Today, Yishai, I saw... So first of all, let's start here in Israel. Here in Israel, Purim is coming, right? It's a holiday of being together and drinking. Yishai, we're writing our names on our cups and no one's allowed to touch
them. Right,
right. Like, we're not such a germy... Not that I'm drinking out of strangers' cups or anything like that, but I wouldn't say I'm like a germy person. But now it's like everyone has to... I bought a giant bottle of Alco-Gel today.
Yeah.
I thought about putting it on a table outside the front door of our house. And like every time you walk in the house, you have to like Alco-Gel your hands.
Right.
But this is like the level that we've gotten to. Purim is coming. And with it, like all kinds of festivities. Israel loves Purim. It's like one of our happiest things. And in Israel, we're so lucky that we even have 2 days of Purim because we have regular Purim. And then some cities, including especially Yerushalayim, have 2 days of Purim.
Right.
But now everything is up in the air. There's some big concerts that have been canceled in Tel Aviv, a soccer state cup quarterfinal match between Maccabi Haifa and Hapoel Be'er Sheva and Haifa Wednesday night. Was canceled. They are the entire Maccabi Tel Aviv basketball team is under quarantine, Yishai.
Oh my God.
Because they went to Spain, the country.
Oh my God.
Right? They went to the country of Spain. Cholon, which has an annual Purim parade drawing thousands of people, canceled.
Bang.
The cities of Ramat HaSharon, Givatayim, Herzliya, Modi'in Maccabim Re'ut, and Carmiel canceling their Purim events.
Whoa.
Jerusalem has a major marathon every year. And originally I heard that event had been canceled. It has like 5,000 runners from abroad, meaning to say there's like tens of thousands of people, including 5,000 runners from abroad. They are considering canceling that race. And that is like millions and millions of shekels. Today I saw a video on Twitter which is like my preferred social media platform.
Yadua, well known.
And I couldn't believe this video. It was some like foreign airline, I want to say like a German airline.
Yeah.
And they were like, listen, the Israeli government is imposing more and stricter guidelines on what will happen to people returning from various European countries. Meaning to say that now, for example, if you go to Italy at all, like if you had a stop over in Italy on your way from America and you come to Israel, you go into 2 weeks quarantine. You go into 2 weeks quarantine. You come back from Spain.
2 weeks quarantine.
2 weeks quarantine in your house.
Well, there is one
self-quarantine.
There is one. El Al is going to get hard hit. A lot of people are hard hit, but there is one organization that's going to be doing real well.
Which?
Netflix. Okay.
Yeah, seriously. And the Alcogel Corporation, right. Like the Dr. Fisher here in Israel. We have this company called Dr. Fisher.
Yeah.
Which makes a lot of like it does local creation of all these like shampoos and all these different things. So they make like Alcogel, and I bought like when have I ever bought like a giant. Never in my life have I bought like a bulk size Alcogel.
I think we should put a slip and slide outside of our house
that's
here.
That's funny. A little Alcogel slide.
Yeah, you have to like just slide your whole body on it.
I like
slip and slide.
Yeah. So you come back from these countries and then you have to go into self-quarantine for 2 weeks, which on the one hand sounds great. On the other hand, sounds like an absolute nightmare. And people who, you know, have to get to work, kids who have to go to school. It's crazy. Imagine being forcibly kept in your house for 2 weeks. Like the first 2 days, you're like, this is the best thing that ever happened to me. Then the next 12 days, you're just like, I got to get out of here. I got to get out of here. I got to get out of here. Right.
Maybe. Or you write your book or learn all of Sefer Yetzirah. Ishai,
you're home with three kids. I tell you what, I'm going to go sit and learn Sefer Yetzirah. You watch the three children for 14 days. Okay.
The kids will go. The kids have to stay in quarantine?
Whoever is in the house. Like, it's a crazy. There's thousands of Israelis under quarantine right now, and we're talking about people who haven't even necessarily come into contact with anybody.
May I ask you a question?
These are people who just came home from countries.
May I ask you a question? And I say this, I want to...
Well, I didn't get to tell you my story.
Oh, just...
Can I tell you? Okay, do you want to ask me the question?
Here's my question. Is it an overreaction or is it proper?
That is one of the big questions.
Because my friend Arthur is in healthcare.
Yeah.
And he's truly concerned about the situation because it is...
It turns out that the coronavirus, look, there's good news and bad news. It's mostly good news. The good news is that like 96% of people are going to be okay.
I read.
The bad news is that 3.5% of people are going to die.
I read that one Israeli patient simply healed and got out of the hospital.
And that's what they're saying. And they're saying, by the way, that like you could have corona. That's why they make you stay in your house for 2 weeks, right?
Right.
Like you could have coronavirus and be hunky dory, completely fine.
Right.
But like you're not getting near anybody else because
how much is mommy's chicken soup going to?
So I, in principle, believe in chicken soup as a Jewish medicinal secret throughout the ages. However, I had a bowl of chicken soup yesterday and I was not miraculously healed.
You had turkey in it.
But it was chicken based. Classic. I think that I usually put two heads of garlic.
Yeah.
And I got lazy and I put one head of garlic.
Yeah, it wasn't the regular chicken
soup. I'm
going
to have to do it again.
Okay.
I'll do it again.
Let's
want to tell you my story.
Go ahead. Story time.
So I saw this video on Twitter. Can I finish this whole story this time?
Go for it.
This feels like 2 weeks of quarantine. Can I? Okay. I'm just kidding. Here's the story. So there, it's somebody sitting in their seat and they're recording a flight attendant going on the loudspeaker. And she's like, listen, Israel has put into place some much like stricter guidelines about travel. And so if you come back, like I think the flight was going to Berlin. If you're coming back, when you come back from your trip, it is entirely possible that Israel will send you into 2 weeks of quarantine. These are Israelis. We are now giving everyone the opportunity to disembark this plane and decide right now. Like Israel had just imposed these things like that the same day. And they're like, listen, we're letting you know. We're giving you the opportunity to disembark the plane. And if you have checked luggage, we'll like get it for you.
Right.
A line of people assembled out the plane. The plane was basically almost empty. Israelis who had bought plane tickets, who had packed their bags, who were on their way somewhere, got off of that plane and went back into Israel. They were like, no, we're not like risking this. And so, that to me was like, whoa, 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 right? It's one thing to be like, I'm not buying a plane ticket now. Bad idea. It's another thing to be like, abort, abort, abort. Yeah. Like, I'm on this flight and I'm get me off the flight. Get me off the flight.
I was with my colleague and buddy, Alex Drayman, today.
Yeah.
And he's got a trip planned in 2 weeks. He's like, I think I'm going to cancel.
He should cancel.
That's what's happening.
You should cancel. Everybody do. It's a nice little call thing they call FaceTime, that they call Skype, that they call WhatsApp video. Okay? You got to meet with somebody. That's how we're going to do it right now.
Yeah. I wonder.
Until this thing, Bezrat Hashem, blows over. I don't know how long it's going to take.
I hope companies like El Al and stuff, who now after my United flight, I feel even more warm and cuddly for.
For El Al?
For El Al. I miss my El Al. I feel sullied. I mean, God bless United. I have no problem. I have
today
no qualms with United.
At the grocery store, they tried to sign me up for the Rami Levy credit card. And I was like, but then my husband's not going to get points
right
for the El Al card. And then I was just like, no, like that. And he was just like, but you get percentages off your purchases. I'm like, well, I will sacrifice it then.
Right.
So that Yishai can get good points on his El Al card.
I've always had a soft place in my heart for El Al, and I like flying El Al, even though it's sometimes more expensive and all that. But it's just I enjoy El Al. But now I'm worried about that airline. I hope they have insurance for the situation.
Dude,
is there insurance for this?
So
kind of
listen. I want to just give you the details. Remember, I was telling you this thing about Germany just now.
Yeah.
Here's the new rules.
Yeah.
So we knew about Italy, right? If you're coming back from Italy, you grab, you know, a few pounds of pasta, some marinara, and you sit in your house for 14 days, okay?
Foo, wow.
And there's over 5,000 people. Oh, no, sorry. Gatherings of over 5,000 people are illegal. Can you believe that? It's like, okay, if you come back, this is unbelievable. You should listen to this list. If you come back from France.
Right.
Germany.
We come from France.
We come from France. If you know what that's from. If you know what that's from, you may get some kind of prize.
Hashtag.
We'll send you one of the pins, the I Heart Israel's Heartland pins that Yishai made for the CPAC.
Yes.
Okay. We'll send it to you in the mail.
Okay.
If you know. We will, before we send it in the mail, we will alcohol gel it.
Sickly. It will come.
I will include an alcohol swab pad.
Right.
Bli Neder in your package. So that, like, dude, Yishai, speaking of which, I know this is all over the place.
Yeah.
But I ordered some stuff from AliExpress.
Yeah.
For those of you who may not know, I don't know what kind of hole you're living in, but AliExpress is a Chinese website where you can buy, like, sort of cheaper. Some things are a lot cheaper there.
Yeah.
So for Purim, a lot of times I like to buy these, like wash off tattoos, you know, you put them on your hand and then you put water and you peel it off and it like stays for a few days. These little tattoos, I like to buy them for Purim and give them out to children as like a cute gift. Anyway, so I ordered them from AliExpress already a while ago. So I got a notification that my package was in from China. And I was like, oh no, I don't want to get coronavirus. So I left it there for a few days because I was like, maybe the bugs will die. And then, literally no joke, I took alcohol swabs with me to the post office to pick them up.
Yeah.
I alcohol swabbed the outside of the package. I alcohol swabbed my hands. Then I opened the package and I alcohol swabbed the packaging inside the package.
Uh-huh.
With the product itself. Yeah. And that felt a little crazy to me, but also unavoidable at the same time. I was just like, I got to do this. Okay. So wait, back to the list. France, Germany. So there you go with that airplane. And the plane was empty, dude. Like the people going to Germany didn't go to Germany today.
Wow.
Spain, Austria, and Switzerland. And obviously China. I don't even know if you can get to Israel from China anymore. They're like, so a lot of people are like, whoa, 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 Israel, what are you doing? It turns out that for now, Israel is not going to be quarantining the United States. However, it turns out that the coronavirus has hit like New York City, which is code for it's coming to Israel. Like, that's another way to say it's like, how could you not be quarantining? That should be the flight that they quarantine. I think that they're scared to cut that one off because that's like the last straw kind of thing. Like, if we cut off New York, that's like saying that we cut off everything. But it's already hit Westchester. It hit Rochester or something like that. It's hit these like different places. My sister, who has kids in New York City, she like kept her kids home from school. So it's going all over the place. Some people think Israel's being a little extreme, but Israel is a country that like does not take its health lightly. I think maybe it's a Jewish thing. I don't know. I think that Israel is like, they don't want the kids to get sick. They don't want the grandma to get sick. They like, they want everyone to be healthy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in Iran, in the they got it right in the parliament for some reason.
Yeah, like 8% of parliamentarians have, right, have coronavirus now.
Okay, Malka, a few emails. Okay,
oh,
Yishai, I was listening to your recent show where your wife mentioned the bat mitzvah certificate that Jerusalem sent your daughter because the city keeps records of those born in Jerusalem. Immediately, I thought of Psalm 87:5-6, and of Zion it shall be said, this one and that one were born in,
yes,
her, in her, and the
Love
Most
it.
High himself shall establish her. The Lord will record when he registers the peoples, this one was born there. As a non-Jew who deeply loves the one true God of Israel,
wow,
it is incredibly exciting to watch his word come to life amongst his people in his land.
Yes, it is.
I am grateful to you and your wife for taking the time to do your show. I listen,
wow,
to all of them. Many blessings to you. Blessings on your family.
Okay.
Krista.
Thank you, Krista.
Nice, huh?
That's super nice.
I tell you.
Wow, blessings back on you, Krista.
Yeah.
Blessings from the Holy Land and from Judea and from Yerushalayim.
This is from Elaine. She says, Shalom Isha, I just finished listening to this week's show. I really appreciate that you put out these shows because you are sharing the truth and beauty of Israel,
wow,
with the world. I had a thought about...
Why do you keep saying Israel?
I don't know, because it's coming from people from around the world. I had a thought about coronavirus.
Yes.
Currently, it appears to be spreading rapidly through Iran. Perhaps Hashem is using this. It seems ironic that this is the season of Purim. May you go from strength to strength.
Amen.
Blessings from Elaine. All
Thank
right.
you, Elaine.
I wanted to... There was definitely another... is this the one? Let's read just a little bit of this one. Yishai, Shabbat Shalom. I've been listening to you on and off since our Rut Sheva days. I've been following you on your podcast and Instagram. The last few episodes, I've been struck by the relationship you share with Malka. You finish each other's sentences, more like we cut each other off, and can correct each other on Torah, Israel, and family. Listening to you is like having coffee with a young couple filled with love and joy. You stun me on how American you sound, and then how quickly you jump into fluent Hebrew. Also, you sound like fun-loving people sometimes.
We do love fun.
Yes. I catch
what
myself...
What do you mean sometimes? What does that mean?
Sometimes I'm not fun-loving. Sometimes I'm really a grouchy jerk. Okay.
Okay.
I just don't want anybody to know that. I catch myself...
Well, luckily you didn't say that on the air.
Good. We'll cut that out. I catch myself laughing at you with you during the podcast as I could sense how much you both love Hashem, Torah, and Eretz Yisrael, and each other. You are a mitzvah to all you receive your insights and wisdom. Hebron is blessed to have you as an ambassador and advocate.
Wow, 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 wow. Feel free to send emails every day.
This is from Mark.
Thank you, Mark. That was very, very nice
in,
of you.
What's AR? AR, is that Arizona? Or is that, oh no, I'm feeling stupid right now.
I think it's
right
in
now.
Arkansas.
Arkansas. That's exactly what it is, Arkansas. Ah, Arkansas. I think I was in Arkansas. I was in the state
you
of Arkansas.
You ever heard of something called Texarkana?
Yeah, I know Texarkana, but I was in Texoma. Which is the region of Texas you're from.
Yes, I'm from Texoma.
That's right. Arizona
sounds so exotic.
Arizona's AZ. Right. Okay. What else? This is from Jeff. Hi, Yishai. I've listened to you since long ago. I first heard about Matisyahu from you from a mention you and Malka made on him on Rutz Sheva one day. Take care, my friend, and may you return from DC safe and sound. I pray that one day to visit the mamas and the papas in Hebron.
Yes. Amen. I hope you do too.
Pray you can be my guide.
Oh.
Shalom Achi from Jeff. Absolutely, Jeff. Looking forward. What an opportunity. That was awesome. I also talked about my new shoes, the leather brown shoes that I bought.
They're pretty snazzy.
They're cool, and I just saw them in the CPAC.
Saw them in the video.
You saw them in the video, right?
They were standing out.
They look good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they look good. Because I could have worn
flashy look.
Because I could have worn my kind of dusty Hebron shoes.
Hebron shoes.
This is from
which there's no shame in.
No shame in at
the
all.
The dust of Jerusalem is like a
yeah, but it's also sure nice to have the sheen of Saks Fifth Avenue. Anyway,
you got it in Saks Fifth Avenue.
No, the you know the closeout place. The what is Saks Fifth Avenue outlet? Yeah.
Wow.
Still overpriced.
So lucky.
Yishai, wear your new shoes in the best of health. Also, buy vitamin C and at least 1,000 milligrams a day for you and your whole family.
Gotta buy the vitamin C.
As a we have some, don't we?
I don't know.
Yeah, sure we do. As a prevention against the virus. Try to find a plant-based vitamin C instead of ascorbic acid. Huh. Some are made in the UK and Canada instead of China. I bought Rosehip's vitamin C in Israel. It will also boost your immune system, but this phone keeps going black. But it is particularly good against the virus. Buy some barrels of them. I was particularly moved.
Buy some what's of them?
Barrels, like large amounts.
Oh, a bunch.
A bunch. I was particularly moved when you said it was good to be in D.C. during the Torah portion of Truma to keep the Third Temple in mind. What you said nourished my soul.
Wow.
I lived and raised my kids in that arrogant, self-important, but deceptively beautiful D.C. area for 25 years. And I'm glad to now live and thrive in Israel, in Eretz Israel, in the land of Israel.
What, not Israel?
My dream. Israel. My dream. That's right. God keep you well, and may you
amen.
Be everything. And may you be everything a shaliach must be in these times. Shabbat shalom from Chaya.
Wow, okay? Thank you, Chaya.
That's awesome.
Wow, Isha, these are incredible emails. These are all emails you got this week.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
And how do people email you if they forgot?
Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. I want to keep going. There's even an email here. I've got to get to, but we're going to get through. We're going to read them straight through. Hi, Yishai. I'm a great fan of your podcast with Rabbi Mike Foyer. I listened to your broadcasting out of Washington today, and again, you emphasized dropping you an email, so I will really need your advice. I really need your advice on settler view on something. Recently, a university in Connecticut canceled their pro-Israel speaker list and exchanged it with this organization, Friends of Roots. Never heard of them. Tell me, this organization creates a message that is not true. We Jews and Palestinians, are not equally rooted in the land. The Jewish people are rooted there over thousands of years. The Palestinians, who came from different Arab countries, have lived there and might have been rooted over 2-3 generations, but nothing in comparison to our history there. I also question the talk of a certain rabbi. He emphasized how we Jews, or rather settlers specifically, came and occupied the land, didn't even see the Palestinians living there. For him, and him, on behalf of others, they didn't exist. I want to write an article in this organization and see it as a dangerous cover. I really appreciate your view on them and how you, as a settler, saw and see the Palestinians. This is from Julia.
Okay.
Just very quickly, I want to say this very quickly. When the Jewish people started coming back to the land of Israel, there were very few Arabs that lived here, and certainly nothing of a nation, certainly nothing of a capital. This was an outlying region controlled in times by Turkey, at other points by Britain, and other points by Jordan in certain parts of the land of Israel. The majority of Arabs, and there's a very thick and almost hard to read book called From Time Immemorial, which lays out the following. Through a lot of data, lays out the following very simple fact.
Okay.
The majority of Arabs have come here in the last 150 years. The majority of Arabs came here because the Zionists provided job opportunities. That's the fact. Okay? The majority of Arabs are here as, I would say, a type of migrant worker. All right? That does not mean that they're not that they're not totally from here, that they're not from the region, this and that.
Or that they don't deserve human rights.
I'm not saying anything like that. But what I am saying is if you tell me that they have some kind of inalienable right of self-determination, I say that is false. They do not have a right for self-determination. They're a conglomeration of people who have come here recently, mostly after the Zionists. Now, there were some Arabs here, but that does not mean that they had a state here or were destined to have a state here. It means that they were living here as peasants on the land, mostly as renters from Syrian landowners. The bottom line is there's no peoples that have the deep connection, the historical connection, the connection that was also recognized as such in the 20s by the international community, and certainly, my friends, not the God-given promise to control and develop this land and create God's house on this land. Okay, let me find yet one more.
That, by the way, is not a settler opinion.
Right. That was not a settler opinion.
That is an opinion.
Right. dystopian reference from Laura. She says the story Malka was referring to is from a Martian chronicle. Is from the Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury. Never saw the movie, but it was also deeply. But I was also deeply affected by the story.
Are we talking about the one with the library and the glasses?
Yes, I think she was referring to. But I remember that. But I certainly remember that in.
I think it was
Twilight
Zone. Twilight Zone. But that. Thank you for that reference.
Okay. Very good. All right. Oh gosh, there's one more. There's one more email. Oh, everybody knew that song, The Cheeseburger in Paradise, was by Jimmy Buffett, writes Dan, my good friend Dan from California. And the Day by Day song is from the musical Godspell. So that line in that movie,
gosh,
Meet the Parents.
Know a lot of stuff.
Meet the Parents, Day by Day.
Oh, yeah, that was a letdown. I wish people had not informed us of that.
That's okay. Also, my dad and sons and I will be walking on Masada.
Wow.
On a certain date. I know the Hebron...
Wait, is it a certain date by which is like basically not going to happen because everyone's going to be in their house from coronavirus?
Don't know.
That makes me wonder also, Pesach is coming. What's going to be?
Mm.
Anyway, keep going.
In any case, so he asks whether I'm going to be touring in Hebron, and I got to get in touch with him. That's my good friend Dan. Dan, God bless you. And
wow.
Dan's also a donor to the Chef Fleischer.
Wow, thank you so much, Dan.
So I want to really thank him.
You got to make sure you reach out.
I really do appreciate it. One second, Malcolm. I'm getting there. I'm getting there. I'm just scrolling back. Oh, here's another. David writes, Godspell. Ironic because you're making... Oh, forget it. Anyway, Day by Day. All right. That's from my buddy David. But there is a important email that's coming. Here we go, Malka. Hey, this is from Judah. Hey, guys. Great show this week, but there are only two parshiot named after non-Jews. What about Noach? Wasn't he, by definition of the mitzvot of Bnei Noach, a non-Jew as well?
Yes.
Keep up the good work. So there you go.
Solid.
Okay. Malka,
is that the one?
No, that's not the one.
Because that is important.
It could be that the person, here we go. This is from Tammy. She writes, "Oh, Yishai, you say the best things. Joy is mine. Joy is mine."
Wow, Yishai.
That's what
you
I wrote.
You and Tammy got to hang out.
I guess I said, "Joy is mine. Joy is mine." She writes, "My new words. I always love the Malka part of the podcast. When you talked about mana cookies for Shabbat, I thought of a cookie my mom made long ago. It was a white puffy cookie that melted in your mouth.
Ooh.
I know. I don't know if this is the same, but here's a recipe I found.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
I love a recipe.
That's right. It's from tasteofhome.com. Are you familiar with
it? I love Taste of Home.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
We didn't make them fancy like this, just spooned little mounds on cookie sheet. So Tammy in Colorado, she says, I would vote for Netanyahu. He's a strong leader, or it seems to me, on the other side of the world.
Dude, that's like the other thing we didn't talk about. Did you talk about that with Rabbi Mike today on the show?
About what?
The election?
Oh, we talked about it. We talked about it for 40 minutes.
Good, and great, because I do not want to talk about it.
She writes, I don't know much about the peace plan, but when I saw the map with Palestine areas within the land of Israel, didn't seem so good.
Yeah, it didn't seem so good to me neither.
It looks like land giveaway. That's what she writes. Thank you, Tammy.
Yeah, Tammy. Touche. It's not looking so good to a lot of us either, frankly.
That's right. Well, at least that aspect.
I mean, we're hoping that there's something there's some good element.
Hold on, Malka. So here's the email that I wanted to read to you. It's from Suzanne or Susan. I don't know. Is there a way to know?
How do you spell it?
S-U-S-A-N.
Susan.
Sure. Hi, Rabbi Fleischer. I listen to you and Reb Mike a lot, but this is the first time I moved to respond to you. I'm a Baalas Tshuva.
Yeah.
I'm a returnee to observancy. Having grown up totally secular and ignorant, my mother also grew up in Brooklyn to Russian immigrant parents in the 20s and 30s, totally secular. It was my father who wanted to have a kosher home, so my mother learned a little, and we had a sort of kosher home, two sets of dishes, and another for Pesach, and shopped at the kosher butcher, but knew nothing about hechsherim. You get the picture. So my father thought nothing of bringing bacon into the house occasionally.
Aww,
what did
cute.
I know? But we were never allowed to have milk on the table with a fleishig meal. Never had a cheeseburger. It's exactly what you said about milk and meat thing being so definitional. My husband and I became Baalei Tshuva after we got married. We have, thank God, three married sons, two of whom live in the land of Israel.
Wow.
And eight grandchildren. Bang.
Two.
Well, man, they should be healthy and well. My husband passed away 7 years ago. But I live in a certain community in New York. And you came to speak to our shul a bunch of years ago, which is how I got on your email list. Kol Kavod, it's a wonderful listen from Susan.
Wow.
So I was talking about, you know, meat and milk being so
identifying mark of a Jew.
And it's like weird. But then when I explained the issue of the two energies that they can't mix, the energy of milk, which is motherliness, which is chesed, and the energy of meat, which is slaughter, which is red, which is not white, which is the opposite. And then suddenly, if you understand that these two energies are there to be separated, you understand why the Torah says, do not cook a kid in its mother's milk, because it accentuates to the point of ridiculous how these two energies, like how absurd would it be to take milk from a mother and boil a kid in it? It's absurd. It's exactly the opposite.
Right. Energies do not mix.
Right. But so the Torah gives you this example of absurdity in order to say to you, and then you see how definitional it is for the Jewish people.
Well, I really appreciate Susan's story and that we talk about this, because it actually relates very closely to how I became religious also.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised in a house that was pretty secular. We definitely did not have two sets of dishes, and I grew up eating tons and tons of cheeseburgers and bacon cheeseburgers, which are delicious. Don't try this at home, okay?
Give
but
out.
It is very good. But when I was in law school, I hung out with – I used to be like more of a guy's girl, so I used to hang out with this guy named Larry. And Larry would eat with me at vegetarian, not kosher restaurants. He would get we used to eat burritos, and he would get a vegetarian burrito with sour cream and cheese, right? And then we would go back to his apartment and eat lunch, and he would take out his milk dishes, and we would eat it on the milk dishes. And I was like, Larry, this is like, I had a whole upbringing behind me, right? And all kinds of, I guess, issues et cetera with Jewish practice.
Chips on the shoulder.
Yeah, I guess you could say baggage. So
Bagage.
And so Israel. And so I would be like, Larry, this is so dumb, right? Like, God does not care what dish you eat your sandwich on. This is not like a major value of... God has other things that he has to, you know, there's bigger problems in the world than what dish you ate on.
Right.
And as you could see, right, Larry himself was an observant Jew, but like to a degree, right? Like he was eating, today as a religious Jew, I would never, ever, ever go eat a vegetarian burrito at some place and put it on my milk dish. None of those things would happen, right? So he was not such a religious Jew.
Right.
And he was just like, just because you don't understand something doesn't make it stupid. And that statement
phrase
that he said to me was the beginning of a quest for information about what it is that God actually does want. And why is the dish thing a thing? And what does God want from a Jew? And why? And look at me now, right? I'm a religious Jew, married to a religious Jew, living in Judea with three religious kids. With my boys have payas, and they wear kippas, and they wear tzitzis, and it all started really from the question of milk and meat,
right? And his assertion
that there are reasons for these things,
and that just because you don't understand,
and it's like, it doesn't seem like a...
which is a very godly statement, which is like, you may not understand me,
and I can only be grateful to Hashem that at that moment when he said that, it like sparked a thought in me.
Okay, Malka, we got to wrap things up, and I want to say thank you to everybody.
I got to get into bed anyway, because my voice is not going to last much longer.
I just want to thank everybody out there for listening, for sending great emails. They are truly moving. So do write an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Much appreciated. That's number one. Number two, check out our sponsors, and our sponsors are godly sponsors if they're the Hebron Jewish community. HebronFund.org and the great tours that we give once a week in the English language to Hebron and the Tomb of Rachel and the Tomb of the Fathers and Mothers. Check that out. And, of course, you can donate there. Our great network is one of our great sponsors, which is the Land of Israel Network, thelandofisrael.com. And we do great work, including building up this farm, not capital, what's it called, center, the home base, the kind of studios, and the center of the operation is at the farm. That's the Arugot farm, which Ari and Jeremy are building up so beautifully. So we're doing great things, including this network. So please donate and listen to our other shows as well. And Tchelet, T-E-K-H-E-L-E-T, that is the true blue Jew, blue string on the tzitzit. It is an amazing thing.
I want to let people know also, it's good that you're promoting them now because Pesach is coming.
Right.
And it is considered a good thing to buy new clothes for the holidays. I try to get, especially for Pesach, when you're really trying to get things that are nice and fresh and new, right? Get your clean clothes. So now is a really good time to gift
right.
to the boys and men in your life.
That's right.
A nice, beautiful pair of tzitzis.
That's right. And finally, YishaiFleischer.com, Facebook.com/YishaiFleischer. I got some new videos for my CPAC event that I put up today. So please check that out. And lots of activity over there. So, you know, do your part. Do the thumbs up and the retweeting and the reposting and send it to a friend and do the stuff to get out more light to the world. If you think it's light, you know what I mean? I don't want to be presumptuous here. But if you think there's light there, then please share it and give somebody else the gift of light. And that's about it. I want to wish everybody a happy Purim.
Happy,
healthy Purim. That's right. I want to wish everybody a refuah shlema, including you, Malka Fleischer.
Thank you, amen.
A full recovery. And all the people who've been struck by the coronavirus, etc. Just only health, only bri'ut, lots of simcha, lots of separating milk and meat, lots of joy and love, and blessings from the land of blessings. Blessings for a great Purim. And may we see that's the hidden revelation in Purim. May we see the revealed revelation in the Purim and the Pesach of the great Exodus, leading to a truly rebuilt third Beit HaMikdash in the land of Israel. We'll figure out the politics. We'll deal with the minorities. We'll give, you know, the good minorities will be blessed. The bad ones will be ousted. Kids will get their presents. Mana will come from heaven. Your bank accounts will be flush, and all you want to do is learn Torah.
All our clothes will look good on us.
That's right. They'll always ironed. It'll be like a 9-iron world, you know. And at the end, really, it'll all be a time where we can get closer to spirituality, godliness, and understand God on a much deeper level, and the whole world will be as one, only for one reason, not because we're going to be homogenized, but rather we're all going to look up to heaven and the great knowledge that's there. So that's about it. God bless you folks from the land of blessings, which is yes. Being blessed as the Jewish people are being ingathered into the land of Israel. Many, many blessings are coming into this world, including great knowledge. That's it, Malka. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat
and Chag Sameach.
Feel good.
God bless you.
Amen.
Amen.
One who doesn't respect and value his past is not worth the honor of the present and has no right to a future. Well, I promise you that I respect and value the past, and I please God, would love to see honor in the present. And I know that all of us have a right to the future. I'm Rav Mike Foyer, and this is The Jewish Story.
Join Rav Mike Foyer for the best Jewish history podcast, The Jewish Story, on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.